Good afternoon, good evening, good morning to some. It's good to see you for this last class in our three-week series on Torah and early Judaism. I come to you not from Skokie, Illinois, but from a very dimly lit and ugly, I think, greenish hotel room on the East Coast. I'm at a conference, so pardon my background, and I hope that my internet will hold up, but that is where I am. I could not give up learning with you, so I ducked out of my conference for an hour, and here we are. All right, 2 weeks ago, if you joined us then, you'll remember that we began this series by talking about how, despite the attitude that oral law is really sort of endemic to ancient Israel and the ideal mode of transmission, writing and writing scriptures was central to Jews, to Israelites, to Judeans in the biblical period, in the Second Temple period. And writing was considered to be a sacred act, a divine act. And human interaction with the written scriptures was considered a sort of barometer for how that individual and the community that he or she represented was interacting with God. And so one could eat the scriptures and be transformed, right? Like with Yechezkel, one could rip up the scriptures like a Judean king, Yehoiakim, right? And when we think about written scriptures as they're described in the Tanakh, there is this oral component as well, because these written scriptures are meant to be conveyed in public to a crowd, read aloud. And so there is not a binary between oral law and written law. And in fact, there is no binary in these between these categories in the Second Temple period at all. The only time, the earliest time that we see the phrase is Torah Sheba'al Peh, Torah Shebichtav, is in the Tanaitic period in the second century. And so in the Second Temple period, we don't have this binary, and Jews are not thinking with this binary. However, of course, these categories interact. Last week, we talked about the translated Torah, and we noted controversy over the question of whether to translate the Torah, whether this was a good thing or a bad thing. We noted that it generally cuts across diasporic and Judean lines. So diaspora Jews who are living in Greek-speaking lands tended to celebrate the translation of the Torah into texts that that they could understand and easily circulate. But over time, Judean authorities expressed discomfort with this. And it's not just about the transmission of the scriptures, but also about the extent to which you acknowledge a permanent diaspora, you legitimize that diaspora, you accommodate the needs of that diaspora. And by the early rabbinic period, the rabbis really are very uncomfortable with translation, whether it's into Aramaic or into Greek. And whereas the Jews of Alexandria commemorated the production of the Septuagint, the official translation of the Pentateuch into Greek, with an annual celebration at Pharos, at the little island right next to the city of Alexandria. By the rabbinic period, there is a day dedicated for fasting and mourning because the Holy Scriptures, the inimitable scriptures, were translated into other languages, which was viewed as a sort of dilution and a corruption of the divine word. So now we're here and we're left with the key question of the series. We finally have to face it. And that question is, when do we get a sense of two distinctive categories of Torah, one written and one oral? Where does this come from? If it's not inherent to the Tanakh, right? For sure, the writers of the Tanakh do not engage with these categories. I think that we've demonstrated that definitively. And if that is the case, where does this idea come from? And so what we're going to do today is try to trace the idea of dual Torah from the Second Temple period up until the early rabbinic period. And when I say dual Torah, I'm careful to not say Torah Sheba'al Peh and Torah Shebichtav, because those are not phrases that were used in the Second Temple period. But the idea that there are two categories of Torah, two modes of transmission, does exist in the Second Temple period. And we're going to look at some sources that speak about two Torahs. Like, what does it even mean, two Torahs? And then we're going to look at some early rabbinic sources that explicitly identify these two Torahs as Torah Sheba'al Peh and Torah Shebichtav. I really appreciate the size of this group. It's amazing that we come together and we've been learning. And the conversation at the end of the hour is a highlight for me. I do ask, as usual, that if you have a question, unless it's for clarity, unless I'm not translating something or I'm going so fast that you can't understand, please try to hold off putting things in the chat because I will be sharing my screen. I won't be seeing your questions until the end, but I do want to hear from you. So start thinking, let it percolate, but please don't put things into the chat until maybe starting in about a half an hour. All right. So let's get started. Now, there should be a source sheet that you all have already seen in the chat, and it's also on the course website. I'm very proud to say this is, I think, my first Torah in motion class ever in which I did not modify the source sheet and I actually kept the rules. So I am not going to invite you. I know this is like a really big accomplishment that I was actually compliant. The source sheet, I think, unless I don't remember, as it appears on the website, is the source sheet that I will be working with today. So you're very welcome. And keep taking my classes and maybe this will happen again in 3 to 5 years. Okay, so we're going to begin with a very enigmatic document, a very famous document. And this is the Book of Jubilees. I'm sure that you've heard of the Book of Jubilees. It's part of the corpus of what's known as the pseudepigrapha. And that is a term that came up a couple weeks ago. The pseudepigrapha, which sounds very fancy and intimidating, but really it's very simple. So first of all, I'm just going to put that word into the chat. It is Greek and it means falsely attributed writings. The category is an artificial one. It's a false one, by which I mean nobody was walking around saying in the ancient world, I'm going to write a text and I'm going to put it into this thing called the pseudepigrapha. The pseudepigrapha is only a word that starts to be circulated towards the end of the 18th century. And it comes from a scholar, a Protestant, I think German scholar named Johann Fabricius, who's a very devout Christian. And he goes around different ancient libraries and mostly monasteries, to be honest. And he is looking for texts that were not canonized, right? Not texts that were included in his Old Testament or New Testament, but texts that would have legitimized or provided sort of proof of his Christian beliefs. And he could never have guessed to what extent this category of pseudepigrapha, that's what he referred to these texts as, how it would have burgeoned and grown and grown and grown. So he identified about 15 texts that were composed anywhere between the 3rd or 4th century BCE and the 4th century CE. And these are texts like Jubilees, like maybe you've heard of Enoch, right? The book, again, these are kind of esoteric, but they were very, very famous in the ancient world. Prayers, novellas, what scholars call rewritten Bible. That's a phrase I very, very much don't like, but you might find it in scholarship. All kinds of texts that might have been considered authoritative by some Jewish and early Christian communities, but ultimately were not canonized in the Western church or the Jewish tradition. And so Jubilees is considered today to be part of the pseudepigrapha. However, so when I say that, you might think, oh, so it wasn't canonized or it wasn't the scriptures of the Christians or the Jews. But it actually is much more complicated than that, because in some Christian communities, and in particular the Ethiopic church, Jubilees is not only canonized, but it's absolutely central. It is the book in their tradition, the most important book in their tradition. And there is a scholar, he's an American scholar, but he's at in Munich. I can't remember the name of his university. It's like Ludwig Maximilian Universität, but his name is Lauren Stukenbrook. And Lauren Stukenbrook has gone to dozens and dozens of churches, Ethiopic churches, and he has made connections with communities that read the Book of Jubilees even today, every single day. It's considered their most precious book. So the church is not a monolithic thing. There are some communities that still read Jubilees, and it's very, very precious to them. In fact, the most ancient versions of this book, besides the Hebrew ones that were found at Qumran, are in Ge'ez, in the Ethiopic language. Why do I say all this? Because sometimes we get we have the impression that when you're dealing with a text that is no longer canonized, it must have always been marginal, must have always been liminal. But Jubilees was fantastically popular. And it was popular among Jews and later was popular among Christians. But there are 15 copies of this book found in the Dead Sea Library. 15, right? No Esther. They didn't like Esther. But 15 copies of Jubilees. It was fantastically popular. And that suggests that at least some Jews, I like that some people are showing me like surprise faces, because yes, it's surprising. And this suggests that at least some Jews were reading this text as authoritative. I think that I've mentioned before, you didn't have this line between everything that was in the Tanakh and everything outside that was heretical in the Second Temple period. Things were a little more fluid at this time. So maybe Jews read Jubilees. It wasn't part of their Tanakh, but it had some kind of authoritative status to it. So what is this text? It's a rewriting of the book of Bereishit and the beginning of Shemot. It is clearly sectarian. So when I say sectarian, I mean that the author could not have represented the majority or the mainstream of Jewish practice in the second century BC. Why do I say that? Because the primary argument of this book is that all Jews need to adopt a solar calendar, which absolutely undermines what Jews are doing, what Israelites, Judeans are doing in the biblical scriptures. And so if you are a Jew in the second century BCE advocating for the observance of a solar calendar, you are assuming that 99.99999% of Jews are eating on Yom Kippur, sacrificing on the wrong days, keeping the holidays on the wrong days, right? And so if you deeply believe in a solar calendar, you are going to have a real chip on your shoulder that pretty much everyone is doing it wrong. And Jubilees has to authorize, the author of Jubilees has to authorize his position. And it's not just about that, you know, the calendar, but there are other traditions embedded in this text as well. And there's a real emphasis on how the patriarchs observed the law, and they kept all the holidays that commemorate things that happened to the Israelites later, right? Very midrashic, proto-midrashic. So the Jubilees is doing all kinds of radical things, and the author needs to authorize himself as someone who can make these points. So on the one hand, Jubilees is very, very sectarian, but it also contains the earliest iterations of traditions that only later resurface in Midrashic texts. So for example, you might have a 5th century Midrash, right, written in Bereishit Rabbah, let's say about Abraham being the fiery furnace, very, very famous Midrash. And you might think, okay, so that's something that Jews came up with in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th century. Well, there's a version of it in Jubilees. That's 2nd century BC. You're pushing some of these traditions back 700 years. And so they're Midrashic stories, maybe not invented by the author, but the author knows of them. He embeds them in his work, and they go up above and below the surface for centuries, and they show up again in Midrashic text. So it's a fascinating work. It's an important work. And again, I don't like these terms, proto-Midrashic, rewritten Bible. We can talk at the end of the hour about how problematic these phrases are. But the point is that Jubilees has to open by making an argument for the authority of his text. And he does that by appealing to two Torahs. This is my very circular and tangential introduction to getting to two Torahs. So now I'm going to share my screen. I have my notes. I have my source sheet. Hopefully I will click on the right. Oh, no. Why isn't it not letting me share? It says finder unknown. See, I'm in a hotel room and I'm very concerned about my level of Wi-Fi here, but I just clicked on share screen and I do not see my documents. Anyone out there want to help me? I know that, yeah.
Were you made a host?
I was. So I can share, like I'm clicking on share. And then I see, I've never seen this before, just like generic finder unknown desktop whiteboard.
Cool. We can see the sources if we click on the URL in the chat. We can pull up the source and look at it ourselves while you're reading.
Yeah, that's incredibly serendipitous that this is the only time I have not changed the source sheet, and I'm pressing on share and my documents are not coming up. And I think that is because I refuse to pay an additional $5 a day to increase my, I had a choice at the hotel desk to add my bandwidth. Maybe I should have done that. But no, I am co-host. I can share, but then the options are just sort of generic. Okay, you don't need to know my whole life here. So please go into the chat, click on the most recent link, that was provided for you. And we're just going to do this together. And anyway, I like this because sharing a screen is annoying and then I don't get to see your faces. So let's just see if this works. Okay. I'm not sure that we have a choice anyway. All right. So you should see, I might have switched some sources around, but you should see Jubilees. Can I get some nods? Okay. Thank you. I get some thumbs up, some nods. All right. Okay. So Jubilees opens with a description of how the text, how this what scholars again call rewritten Bible, this revision, extended version of Bereshit and part of Shemot through the Exodus was handed down from Moses, some kind of revelatory work. This is not atypical. In the late Second Temple period, it would have been common for Jewish writers to say, this text that I'm writing for you was received by, and you know, insert name of prophet here, right? We have four books of Ezra. We have books attributed to Baruch, the scribe of Yirmiyahu. This is why the whole collection is called pseudepigraphy, right? Attributed text to an older figure. And so Jubilees does that. So let's look. In the first year, this is how the story opens. In the first year of the Exodus of the children of Israel, please do unmute. If you can't see something, if you need help, just jump in. In the first year of the Exodus of the children of Israel from Egypt in the third month on the 16th day, okay, God spoke to Moses saying, come up to me on the mountain. I will give you the Luchot, right? Remember, we talked about that, I think, 2 weeks ago, where God, it's emphasized over and over and over that God writes the Luchot. I think we have that noted five times in the Torah. And I shall give you, I think that might be a typo, two stone tablets of the law and the commandments, which I have written so that you may teach them. Okay, so in this Torah, God writes, this is like straight up, this seems to be very consistent with what we find in Shemot, Lamed Bet, Lamed Gimel, Lamed Dalet. Moshe is told, well, even before that, Moshe is told, come take these luchot, God is writing upon them. But then there's a whole secondary corpus, and this gets very confusing. So let's try to work through this together. Okay, so Moshe goes up the mountain, and the glory of the Lord dwells upon Har Sinai, and a cloud covers it for 6 days. And then Moshe, after a week, right, Moshe is called by God in the midst of the clouds. This is like paraphrasing actual Shemot when Moshe is on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. Although even there, it's very unclear whether you should include, it's like Parshat Mishpatim, Terumah and Tetzaveh, is all of that part of the 40-day period? When does that 40-day period come to an end? The chronology is very unclear and contradictory. Okay. The Lord revealed to Moshe both what was in the beginning and what will occur in the future. Fine. The account of the division of all the days. And so already there seems to be material that Moshe is receiving that does not get recorded on the Luchot or does not get sort of included in this corpus of material that's going to be transmitted to the people of Israel. And indeed, God says to Moshe, set your mind on everything which I will tell you on this mountain. Write it in a book. Okay, so is this like the same book or is this a totally different book? Like, what is this book, right? Write in a book so that their descendants might see that I have not abandoned them on account of all the evil which they have done to instigate transgression of the covenant. And so it seems like this is the book, right? So is Jubilees that book? So you have like the Luchot or the Torah, and then that's the scriptures that we read from, or that, you know, again, it's not clear, like, is it the Luchot? It's the Luchot, but maybe it's also the Pentateuch. And then you have this other book. What is this book? Okay, so they will know that I've not abandoned them on account of all the evil which they have done to instigate transgression of the covenant. This is a very hard translation, which I'm establishing between me and you. And then go down a few lines and write for yourself all these words, which I will cause you to know today. So write a separate book that's not, you know, part of the Torah. For I know their rebelliousness and their stubbornness before I cause them to enter the land, which I swore to their fathers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so it seems like there are two books, right? They're both written, maybe, right? There's the version that is going to be the official version that's going to be written up for the people and their descendants. And this would be presumably the Torah. And even here, you know, I'm not totally clear. Like maybe the Peshat is not the Torah, right? Maybe the Peshat is the Luchot, right? And then some written document. But there seems to be two different things. And one is for the public and one is for Moshe to hold on to. Why would Jubilee structure it this way? For Moshe to hold on to a certain corpus of material that's not for the people until a later time. Well, in a way, this sort of authorizes the author of Jubilees to be creative and say, listen, I am the inheritor, the recipient, the transmitter of this ancient tradition that goes back all the way to Moses that you have never been privy to. Right? And so it sounds a little bit like what the rabbis do in the second century with Torah Shib Baal Peh, where the rabbis say, listen, we're writing something down, but we are not the inventors of a new tradition. We are merely the recipients. And that, by the way, is a little bit, it's a little bit not true. I mean, of course, the rabbis are radical innovators, but okay. The rabbis claim to be recipients of an unchanged tradition that only then was being recorded. And that's precisely what Jubilees is doing here, right? So the first corpus, let's say it's the Luchot, okay, written, that's the text that the people get. And then later, the written Pentateuch is built off of the Luchot, but you have the Luchot, and that's what the people are going to get when Moshe comes down the mountain. And then you have a book that Moshe is going to hold on to. And this book is going to be a testimony against the people when they sin. And that does not seem to be the written Torah. That seems to be the Book of Jubilees itself. This idea that you have like one thing for the people, and then you have something else that not everyone should have access to, or not everyone should have access to right away, actually appears in numerous Second Temple sources. And I want to take you to the first century CE philosopher, Philo. Philo also is working with, I guess you would call it a dual Torah model. But this is a very different model. Philo wants to portray the patriarchs. Should I say a little bit about Philo? I mean, I've talked about him before, but okay, fine. I'll say a little bit about Philo. All right. So Philo also gets a bad reputation. Philo's years are around 20 BCE to 50 CE, very influenced by allegorical methods, by Stoicism, by Greek philosophy. All of this is to say is that Philo wants to find deeper meaning in the scriptures. So you have the text itself, and then you have the hidden, more allegorical, truer meaning. And Philo, because he was preserved by the church, because he's not cited in rabbinic literature, because he doesn't really have a place in like mainstream Jewish tradition, Philo is often misunderstood or miscast as a Hellenized Jew. And that's simply not the case. Philo is not a Hellenized Jew. Philo is enamored of Greek philosophy, but is very explicit that he believes that Judaism is a superior philosophia. Judaism, its scriptures, its teachings, its moral values, comprises a superior philosophy to what the Greeks can offer. He's very explicit about it. So anyone who says, oh, Philo's just like mushing things together, like, let me put Judaism in the pot, let me put Greek philosophy in the pot, and then just stir it together, and here's what I come up with. That's not fair to Philo. Because, oh, hold on a second. A participant requests that live transcription. That probably means I'm going too fast, but I'm going to click on enable. All right. So Philo is not merely a syncretist. Philo is trying to make an argument that Greek wisdom is concurrent, right, is consistent. Oh no, but that's distracting to me. Is there a way to hide it?
Just click X.
Okay. Yeah, but I want to make sure that other people can see it if they need to see it. No, I still see it. Is there a way to get rid of that? Hold on a second.
Yeah, the little X. There's a little tiny X next to it. Just click the X. Make it go away.
I did click on it. See, we don't have our MC. She's on her way to the airport. Hold on one second. Can we please disable this?
You were doing fine without it. Why did you bother with it?
Because somebody requested it. Hold on. Disable. All right. Hopefully that works. All right. So Philo, where was I? Philo is arguing that Greek teaching is coherent with Judaism, but Judaism is always superior. And he argues against Jews in Egypt, particularly Jews in Alexandria, who are abandoning the literal practice of Jewish law, provided that they understand allegorical meaning. In other words, there are Jews in Alexandria who are saying, I understand that the allegorical significance of male circumcision is that we have to excise the temptation of indulging in physical pleasure. Now that I understand that allegorical meaning of circumcision, I don't need to circumcise myself, right? Or I understand that dietary law is about separating myself from the impulse to integrate into whatever, blah, blah, blah. And therefore, having understood that allegorical meaning, I no longer need to observe the dietary laws. Philo says that's absolutely disingenuous. The scriptures demand that we both observe the laws and appreciate or seek to understand their allegorical meaning. And so he's a centrist in his own mind. Of course, we're all moderates in our own mind. But he's not, if you look at the sort of spectrum of Jewish observance in Alexandria and Egypt, he's not an extreme, you know, assimilationist or an apostate. He's really trying to walk the line of making a defense for ancestral Jewish practice, but framing it in a philosophical way. So we like Philo. I like Philo. Now, what does he do with the patriarchs? Now, remember how I said that some Second Temple traditions resurface in later Midrash? One of the themes of Bereishit Rabbah, which is a 5th century collection of Midrashic texts, is that the patriarchs observed Jewish law, right? They kept holidays, which commemorate things that hadn't even happened yet. Well, guess what? Philo agrees. And the reason why this is significant is because Philo conceives of two categories of law. There's the written law of the Jewish people, and that's the Torah. Right? And that law has to be recited regularly in the synagogues. There are many synagogues in the city of Alexandria. But then there's what Philo calls the unwritten law. I cannot believe it's 2:30. I'm on source two. That's okay. Then there's the unwritten law. And for Philo, this is natural law. What does he mean? I'm not going to go into a whole treatise about what natural law is in general. But what does Philo understand natural law to be? That once you achieve a certain level of philosophical and pietistic perfection in the Jewish framework, you intuit how to live as a Jew and according to its laws. And so Philo argues that patriarchs such as Abraham, Isaac, Jacob were so philosophically sophisticated that they intuited practices that are specific to the Jewish people and that are found in the written law. So this is quite complicated, but you can see what would have motivated him to make this argument. And so if you look at this first source, this is his treatise called On Abraham. This is the very opening paragraphs of this treatise. And he says, the patriarchs, I hope you all see that, are such men as lived good and blameless lives. Their virtues stand permanently recorded in the Holy Scriptures, not merely to sound their praises, but for the instruction of the reader and an inducement to elicit emulation, right? These are role models that we should copy their behavior in all things. And in these men, we have laws endowed with life and reason, as Moses extolled them for two reasons. Moses took the time, right? Moshe, who's the writer of the Torah, took the time to really write a lot of details about their lives. Why? He wanted to show that the enacted ordinances are not inconsistent with nature. Anything that you think is irrational in the Torah actually is consistent with nature. Everything is rational. Of course, think about his cultural context here. Philo would have found it unacceptable for God to have given instructions or commandments that have no reason or purpose. And so he's saying, well, you plebeian, to use a Roman word, you plebeians might not understand that allegorical, now I'm mixing Romans with Greeks, the meaning behind these texts, but that's your problem, buddy, because the patriarchs understood them, right? Those who wish to live in accordance with the laws as they stand have no difficult task. Even the first generations, right, the patriarchs, Abraham and his family, before any at all of the particular statutes were set in writing, followed the unwritten law with perfect ease, so that one might properly say that the enacted laws are nothing else than reminders of the life of the ancients. In other words, there's this kind of lovely image of continuity here, that everything that we do can be traced all the way back to the patriarchs who intuited these laws based on their philosophical perfection. And I really appreciate the confidence with which Phyla just lays it all out there, you know, because you have to understand that Alexandria was a very tricky place in the early first century CE. And in fact, I think I've mentioned this before, there was a lot of anti-Jewish violence. There was accusations of Jewish misanthropia. And of course, at the same time, like today, there was incredible Jewish success. And so Jews were rising in, you know, in politics and positions that gave them a lot of power. And concurrently with that, there was a lot of resentment against those Jews who lived in the city and had the ear of the emperor, had the ear of, you know, prefects, procurators. And Phyla was very sensitive to anti-Jewish accusations and just very vociferously defends the integrity and the rationality of Jewish laws. And other treatises that he writes goes into detail about how these laws are rational. We don't have time to do that today. But the point that I want to make to you is that there's this concept of the Torah, the written Pentateuch, that isn't the sum total of the Jewish scriptures, right? So even at this early stage, you have this sort of dual Torah. Now, Jews are conceiving of this duality in different ways, right? For Jubilees, you have the Luchot that's handed down to the people of Israel, that sort of embodies a written tradition. And then you have something that Moshe holds on to that doesn't get written down until the author of Jubilees writes it down, right? It's kind of like a radical vision of it. But for Phyla, it's the written Torah and natural law, which he thinks can be intuited. And we're going to see a slow evolution to what I think gets us to oral law and written law, and consider why this evolution is important. As usual, I might have to quicken my pace. I don't know. Okay. All right. So let's go to one of my favorite collections. This is dated to around the first century CE, and it's known as the Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs. I love this collection. First of all, it doesn't get its due because, again, it's collected in the pseudepigrapha. It was transmitted by Christians. The Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs were composed. I'm going to say this knowing that some scholars disagree with me, but I don't care. They were composed by Jews. This is a collection of 12 mini speeches that were attributed to the children of Yaakov that were supposedly given on their deathbeds to their children. In other words, what did the children of Yaakov, the 12 tribes, say to their children on their deathbeds? Well, some Jews in the late Second Temple period were very curious about this question. They imagined the speeches that the 12 tribes would have given. And each of these speeches are tailored towards what we know about the lives of the tribes. So we have Yehudah, you know, talking about, you know, picking up on details of his life. We have Shechem talking about what happened with Dina. And then, sorry, not Shechem, we have Levi. And actually that's the speech that I have passages on in our source sheet. I'm talking about Dina. We have Yosef talking about morality, ethics, and leadership. I mean, so we have the writers of this collection sort of picking up on hints in the Torah and developing them into a speech. Now, one of the ways that we really do know that Jews wrote these texts is because an Aramaic version of the Testament of Naphtali, a little scrap, was found. Anybody want to unmute and tell us if they know where it was found, the Testament of Naphtali? It was found in the Dead Sea Scrolls in the Qumran Library. Yeah. So we have little scraps in Hebrew. I mean, so again, you have a situation where there's a very compelling argument to be made that there's an Aramaic or Semitic, maybe Hebrew, original to some or all of these texts. Now, it also could be that, you know, the Testaments were a genre. There's also the Testament of Solomon. There's the Testament of Abraham, Testament of Isaac. There are different Testaments. This is a genre of literature that Jews and then later Christians were interested in. Like, what are the deathbed speeches of the great biblical heroes? So it could be that not one person wrote the Testaments. It could be that they were written by different Jews and later was compiled into a collection. Unfortunately, by the second or third century, the Christians who are circulating this collection are interpolating references to the Trinity into it. So if you were to look at the text, it's not unfortunate. I mean, it's very nice for them, but it's tricky for us. Because if you were to look at the Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs now, you would see opening lines, right, that speak of Christ or the Trinity. And just be mindful that that's not compelling proof that these texts were written by a Christian. There's very positive attitudes towards the priesthood in these texts. So you would probably not have found that by a third or fourth century Christian. Very positive attitudes towards the Jerusalem temple. References to Jewish laws, like mourning laws in the Testament of Shimon. Mourning laws, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. There's levirate law references. And so you have positive attitude towards the law, the cult, also a terrible word that I don't recommend using. But so I treat this as a Jewish collection. And I want to take you to the Testament of Levi, one of the most interesting of these speeches. And Testament of Levi seems to allude, we could just do this briefly, but it alludes again to two modes of transmitting scriptural authoritative information. One is in chapter 10, where he says, my children, whatever things I've heard from my fathers, I've declared to you. That seems to be like a very oral, right? Like my fathers, I heard from them, right? And now I'm telling you. So there's like oral transmission. And yet at the same time, I think this is like a very sweet instruction that comes towards the end of the book. He says, and don't forget to teach your children how to write. Yeah. And so also we sometimes have like a misconception of ancient Judaism where like nobody was literate and nobody knew how to read. But the question of Jewish literacy is a controversial one among academics, and we really don't know. But I think that given the centrality of the written word, it does seem to me like the literacy rates would have been relatively high in comparison to others in the Hellenistic world. And so here you have the writer saying, make sure that your children know how to read, right? They need to know their letters, right? So you ought to teach your children letters that they may have understanding all their life in order to read the law of God without ceasing. And so here, law, again, I think I've said this before. Whenever you see the word law in a translation of an ancient text, be aware it's probably Torah, just because this is a bad translation. And a lot of these texts were translated in the modern era. And so Torah becomes mistranslated as law because the Christian Protestant who decided to write this this translation thought, oh, you know, Torah equals nomos in Greek, which equals law. Well, no. So my thinking is that the original, I think that the Greek here is nomos, and I would not translate nomos as law, I would translate it as Torah. Anyway, okay, so again, you have these like two modes of transmission of authoritative knowledge to your children. Just want to point that out. I think I have to skip for Ezra, but I wanted to point out to you, this is a late first century text. It's an apocalyptic work, very intriguing, but it's significant to me because like Jubilees, it talks about scriptural texts that are for everybody, and then texts that are equally authoritative and scriptural that need to be hidden, that are not for everybody, that are only for the elite, or only for those with proper understanding, or only for the prophets until the end time when they shall be revealed to all people. So again, you have this idea that like what you're seeing before you, it's not the sum of all parts. It's not everything. There's even more beyond. Oh, I really wanted to spend more time on Josephus, but I don't think I have that much time. So my friend Josephus, around 37 to 100, those are his years, born in around 37 CE. And Josephus, in numerous places, talks about the sectarian divisions in Judea in the Second Temple period, in the late Second Temple period. And depending on where Josephus is writing about the sects, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Essenes, he gives different reasons for why they are divided or why they're like what's at the core of their divisions. And so in one place he says, well, it has to do with their attitude towards fate, towards free will. According to the Essenes, there's no free will. According to the Sadducees, everything is free will. God doesn't know what's going to happen. And the Pharisees are sort of the moderates in the middle. Elsewhere, he says, well, it has to do with resurrection. Or it has to do with the authority of written law. The Sadducees reject the written law. So it just depends. I mean, the truth is, like, in my opinion, none of these explanations get to the heart of these sectarian divisions, because ultimately the divisions have to be more pragmatic. They have to have practical stakes. Like, I live next door to someone, I live in a modern Orthodox community where I'm sure there are many people who don't believe that God wrote any part of the Torah, and then others believe that God wrote every single word, every single letter, and we're in the same community. To really be a sect, there has to be a political stake. I don't want to get more into this, but the fact that Josephus gives so many reasons for why the sectarian communities are divided also tells you that he's not quite sure that it's not just one thing. But in one section of his 20-volume work that reviews all of Jewish history, starting from the beginning of Genesis, this work is his magnum opus, known as Antiquities of the Jews. He describes the Pharisees as being uniquely positioned to transmit the tradition of God's teaching to the people. So look at that. And he says here, I'm not going to go through the whole context over here of Jonathan and Hyrcanus, this is first century BCE politics over here. But he says, well, you need to know Hyrcanus. I'm pretty sure the Hyrcanus here, I have to double check, I'm pretty sure the Hyrcanus here is the son of Salome Alexandra. When she died, she was the wife of Alexander Yanai, the terrible king who crucified 800 Pharisees. When Salome Alexander died in 67 BC, she had two sons, Aristobulus, who was pro-Hellenization and allied with the Sadducees, and then Hyrcanus, who was allied with the Pharisees. Okay, so he just look at this parenthetical comment. He says, the Pharisees, towards the end of the paragraph, have delivered to the people a great many observances by succession from their fathers, which are not written in the law of Moses. And for that reason, for that reason it is that the Sadducees reject them, right? The Sadducees say, if it's not in the written Torah, it's not authoritative. And they say we are to esteem those observances to be obligatory, which are only in the written word. And concerning these things, it is that great disputes and differences have arisen among them. So the question here is this the earliest reference we have to Torah Sheba'al Peh, to oral law? Is this it? Is this first century allusion to how the Pharisees transmit traditions from their parents, from their fathers, mothers? Is this the first really explicit reference? I would not say that Philo talks about oral law. He has this idea of unwritten law, natural law, but he's not really saying that there's Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh, right? And for sure it's not in Jubilees either. So is this it? Well, scholars disagree. And I would say that the consensus now is that Josephus, scholars take a conservative, more cautious reading towards this passage, and they say no. And again, I'm not sure that I'm on board, but the consensus is that Josephus did not have in mind an oral law versus a written law model that you find in rabbinic texts. I am on the fence. I think that there is something going on here that does seem to be what we would call proto-rabbinic, right? This phrase, which are not written in the law of Moses, it seems pretty oral to me. So it's unclear. Is this conceived in the way that later rabbis conceive the oral Torah and the written Torah? But here's what you need to know, and this is what's so important. I finally got to it 45 minutes after the class started. Even the rabbis disputed the two Torah model. Even early rabbinic passages record debates over whether this is the right way to approach transmitted authoritative tradition. And we're going to look quickly at a passage where Rabbi Akiva says, okay, I get it. You want to think of it this way, written law, oral law? Well, I don't. I think that there are a lot of Torahs. And so even in the second century, you don't have consensus over how to really understand the transmission of authoritative ideas. So in our very limited time, I just want to point out this super famous Mishnah from Avot. Moses received the Torah from Sinai. Do you see that? Can I get some nods? Right. And I just think, thank you. I just think that this is so intriguing, the lack of the article, right? No, hey, no, the. What did Moses get? He did not get the Torah, right? He got Torah. And this is not the same thing, right? Because if it were to say Moses got the Torah, you might think of something sort of concrete, static, immobile, tangible, material. I'm just saying synonyms, right? But when you say Moses got Torah, there is an implication that it's more conceptual and less tangible. And so I think that this idea, Moses got Torah, sort of opens up the category to something that's really fluid, really broad, and clearly includes material that goes well beyond the written scriptures, right? Moses got Torah. That missing hay, there's so much that you could say about the rest of the Mishnah, but I'm not going to say I'm not going to say more about that, but I just want to, yes, of course, oral law was not a light switch. It was absolutely a process. Okay. So just note that idea of Torah is emerging as something that's much more extensive than the Pentateuch or the Tanakh. Okay, now, if you look at this early Midrash on Sifra B'chukotai, this is what I was talking about when I said that there's this anonymous opinion in the Sifra that you have two Torahs, right? So you have... this is learned out from a pasuk in Vayikra. You have two Torahs. You have the Echad Bechtav, Echad Baal Peh. You have the oral one and you have the written one. Rabbi Akiva is like, well, actually, no. I mean, I can learn out from other psukim that there are lots of Torahs. Like, look at all these phrases where the word Torah appears. Why are you limiting us to two? Look at, there's like all this multiplicity of Torahs. And so I think it's interesting to think about, like, why does Rabbi Akiva not feel comfortable with the dual Torah model? Like, why does he say, well, listen, you know, look at all these phrases, and I'm just going to read the English over here. It's too hard to do with the English because I don't like this translation. Look at these phrases from Vayikra and from Bamidbar, right? Zot Torah Ta'olah. This is the teaching about the Ola sacrifice. Zot Torah Ta'mincha, Zot Torah Ta'ashan, Zot Torah Zavach Shalim. I think he's trying to be funny. I think he's trying to be like, well, what about this Torah, that Torah, this Torah? And of course, they're all like in the context of ritual sacrifice, which also tells you that this Torah is, has maybe taken on a new significance in the absence of the temple. I'm only bringing this to you, and we can talk about this more in the remaining time that we have in conversation, because I think it's important to know that, even in the second century, in the early second century when Akiva lived, Torah was expansive. And it seems like Akiva feels somewhat limited by this idea of like oral, written. And maybe he feels that it's limiting because he worries that the written tradition is at some point going to become limited as well. And he wants to keep it expansive. So I don't know. But I think it's important to know that it was still disputed as a category. I'm not going to do Shabbat 31a, but it's an interesting passage you could look at on your own. What I want to just end with is a really lovely paragraph written by Rav Hirsch in the late 19th century. And what I like about this articulation of how the written Torah and the oral Torah relate to each other is that it seems like Rav Hirsch tries to bring these corpora back into sort of like integration again. So I'll just end with this. So Rav Hirsch says as follows. This book, the Torah, was meant to be given into the hands of those who are already well informed in the law, simply as a means of retaining and reviving ever afresh this knowledge which had been entrusted to their memories. In other words, the written Torah is to the orally transmitted Torah, like short notes on a full and extensive lecture on any scientific subject. And so I think what he's saying here is like anything that you find in the oral Torah, you will find the seed, the kernel in the written tradition. And so for the student who has heard the whole lecture, short notes are quite sufficient, right? The Torah, to bring back fresh to his mind at any time, the whole subject of the lecture. For him, a word, a question mark, an exclamation point, a period, the underlining, it's often enough for him to recall a whole series of thoughts. But for those who had not heard the lecture from the master, such notes are useless, right? You can't just open up a Torah if you don't have the learning and the context. You can't just open up, the middle of Vayikra and really understand what it's trying to do. If they were to try to reconstruct the scientific contents of the lecture from such notes, they would of necessity make many errors. And I like how he tries to sort of like layer this onto a scientific discipline. But what I think is poignant about this imagery is that what Rav Hirsch is doing is exactly what the late biblical authors are doing. In other words, you remember when I said you don't have a binary that separates the written and oral tradition in the Second Temple period. Maybe you do it in the first century, but for the vast majority of the Second Temple period, these categories are actively interacting and engaging with each other, right? And so you have these very lovely images in Nehemiah, where the written is oral and the oral is written, right? Ezra is reading the text, but he's reading it out loud and he's transmitting it to people who will then tell their children and neighbors and friends what they heard Ezra read from the text. And so inherent to the Tanakh is an interplay between written and oral. It's never meant to be two separate bodies that run parallel to each other. It's always meant to engage, to evolve. Well, maybe I'm not going to say evolve when it comes to the written text. I'm not adding any books to the Tanakh. Don't worry. But these categories are meant to interact with each other. And I think that Rav Hirsch wants his readers to appreciate how the written law is meant to be read in conversation with the Torah. And I'll end with this joke that a yeshiva student, I'm not going to look at the chat quite yet. And also, if you send it just to me, please send it to everyone, if you don't mind, if you're comfortable with it. Thank you. So a yeshiva student, how do I translate yeshiva? I don't know. Okay, fine. I'll keep going. Goes to his parents' house after spending 6 months studying Talmud and studying rabbinic sources. And he goes to his parents' house and he looks at his parents' shelves and he realizes he's never really taken a serious look at his parents' shelves. And he's just amazed by what he sees. And he thinks like, well, I've never really appreciated what my parents have on the shelf. I'm going to open up some books and see what they have. And he pulls a volume off the shelf and he's absolutely amazed by this text that he sees. He cannot believe what he's reading, and he's just, his jaw drops. And his parents see that he's very surprised and excited, and they say, you know, Shlaimi, what are you looking at? What is this that you're reading? And he says, you're never going to believe what I found. I found a book that cites every verse in the Talmud. Okay, ha 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 ha. It's the Tanakh. All right, it's hard to tell jokes over Zoom. Okay. But Rav Hirsch would have been very mad by that joke, because he would never have wanted a model wherein Jewish, you know, adults, children are studying the oral law outside of its scriptural basis. All right. Now, you know, we have to give some time for conversation, for discussion. So I'm going to take a look finally at the chat. With the Rambam, I've been aware of Philo. Look, you have two very Aristotelian thinkers who are trying to rationalize the scriptures and provide that framework of logic. But I don't know that Rambam was reading Philo, but there's a lot of interesting scholarship that compares how they approach seemingly irrational law in the scriptures. Okay, isn't revelation of hidden knowledge the definition of apocalyptic? So the pseudepigrapha, like Jubilees belong. Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so for sure, for Ezra is apocalyptic. Jubilees doesn't have so much, it doesn't really have material about the end of days. And there's a lot of debate about how to translate apocalyptic. So if you're thinking about it in the framework of the eschaton, right, the end of days, then it would not be apocalyptic. But I agree with you that apocalypta actually means something hidden, right? So do scholars treat Jubilees as an apocalypse? No, but linguistically you have a good argument, and there is this aspect of hidden knowledge that was very important to Jubilees and to other writers. Sifra Bukogotai, I just got a private question about the dates. It's an early midrash. There's a lot of things happening right now in the chat, and I didn't even scroll up yet. So can we, okay, first of all, what I always like to do is send you my email, and so you can always send me questions, but iPad is raising his or her hand. So iPad, you can unmute and ask a question or share a comment.
Okay, thank you. The passage in Jubilees where Moses, they quote Moses in Exodus, we know in Deuteronomy Moses is out Mount Nebo. And I don't remember if it's the main text or a midrash where he sees the future. So is this one text influencing the other text, that when Moses is there, and we have the whole thing about when the children of Israel sin, and it's not in his lifetime, it's afterwards. So that's all future stuff that's hidden from him, or not hidden from him, hidden from us, revealed to him. So I'm just wondering if that section of Torah and midrash influenced Jubilees. And then the other question I had, I love this idea of hidden books, and it reminds me of the movie The Name of the Rose, where there was a hidden Aristotelian book.
Yeah,
and
Umberto Eco. Right, Umberto Eco?
Yes, yes. So I always wonder if, you know, like, so other traditions have this too, and it's,
yes,
it's, you know, that's all. That's my question and my comments. Thank you.
Okay, so I think that what you're referring to is Devarim, Chavchet, Chavtet, Lamed, right? So those are the curses that predict that the people are going, this 28, 29, 30, that the people are going to abandon the covenantal laws and then be kicked out. Look, I don't think that that's the future. I think it's a warning, right? So the prophets, the main argument of the prophets is like, you can change course. We don't want the predictions in the Torah to come true. Then of course they do. So is that telling the future or is that a warning? I don't know if that's semantics, but I don't read that as like a prophecy. I read it more like as a warning, but certainly Jubilees is aware of that text. And certainly Jubilees thinks that people are really messing up. And he's repeatedly critical of the people of Israel for doing it wrong. So I think he's sensitive to Devarim, but I don't think that he's necessarily viewing it as like, you know, prophecy. I forgot your second comment, but I remember thinking that was really interesting. What was your second comment?
About the name of the rose.
The tradition of hidden knowledge. Look, I mean, it keeps the leaders in power, not to be cynical about it, but it keeps, that was pretty cynical. I'll just agree and say the idea of hidden books that not everyone has access to is absolutely something that appears in other traditions. Okay, is a reference be on your heart, Deuteronomy 6:5, what Father may have had in mind when he talked about Torah being intuitive. I don't know if he quotes that. I have to look it up to see if he quotes that verse. But For Philo, it's like a philosophical knowledge. Like if you perfect yourself philosophically and you observe God's law, then you intuit. Then God's law becomes natural law. So I don't know. It's very nice insight. Shlomo uses Torah Mishle to mean not the Torah, but curious enough, natural law. I think, okay. I would love to see that pasuk. I would love to see that, Ruth Shane. You could email me that pasuk and I'd love to see it.
No, it's not just one pasuk. He uses it all the time.
You mean like Ashkarati Mecha? You're talking about like those psukim in Mishlei?
Those are just quotes from the Torah. But when he's using it in not as a quote, but he's just saying it, he's not necessarily referring to the Torah. He's talking about morals and ethics.
And in Tehillim, yeah.
And so it's all over the place. It's not just
For sure it is. And I've given lectures on the word Torah in Tanakh, and it absolutely becomes generic. I mean, it absolutely is generic before it comes to designate a specific written text. No question about that. Mishlei is one of the Seder figure. I'll have to hear more about that another time. I guess you're saying that because it's attributed to Shlomo. All right, one last question. Asher Stein, please.
Maybe I'm being simple-minded, but the Torah, the text of the Torah, there are no verses. There's no vowels. All of the letters are they're only letters. But how do you pronounce the words? Where do you put the psukim? There's no Tamiya Mikra. That's a later tradition. So I would suggest that the Torah, that we call it the text of the Torah, is a dual thing in and of itself. It has to be because you can't read it any other way.
That's exactly what the source that I skipped is saying. If you look at Shabbat 31a, that's exactly Hillel's point, is that you cannot understand the Torah without that teacher to student tradition. So take a look at that. I'm sure that you know this story about what Hillel says with the Aleph Bet and the Gentile who's sort of testing Shammai and testing Hillel. So I think that that's absolutely right. And I think the rabbis were very sort of keen on that idea, and you see it come up not only in that source but in others too. I have nothing to say to to nuance or complicate that. I think you're totally right. Okay, well, my time is up. I guess I have to go back to the conference now, but this was much more fun. Thank you very much for learning with me. Thank you for being such wonderful participants. I love, even those of you who do not comment, I love your facial expressions. It really has been a pleasure to be with you. And I don't know when I'll next teach for Torah Motion. So have a wonderful Shavuot. I hope that this maybe serves to inspire you a little bit in advance of that Chag, and be in touch.